Thank you very much, Alessia, for the introduction, and thank you, well, for inviting me to give this talk here, and thank you all to be here. So, this work is about the Einstein equivalence principle, and in particular, how it can be generalized when we, instead of having abstract reference frames, we consider reference frames associated to quantum systems, which we call quantum reference frames. And also when the gravitational field is not in a classical state, but is in a superposition of classical states. And I'm going to make all these ideas hopefully more precise in the following. But first, let me start with the motivation for this work. So the Einstein equivalence principle is one of the fundamental principles of general relativity, and in particular because arguably it is related to the metric structure of GR. But apart from being one of the fundamental principles of the theory, it is also a very useful experimental tool to test alternative theories of gravity. And in particular, because of this deep relation that it has with the metric structure. But what we know about the Einstein equivalence principle holds for, well, general relativity, so a classical spacetime. So we could ask what happens if we want to go beyond this situation. For instance, in what I call gravitating quantum systems, which are, for instance, a mass that is being put in a special superposition of different locations. So in this case, we do not have a classical spacetime anymore, and we do not know whether the Einstein equivalence principle will hold or not. And whatever we find is going to be interesting, because if we find that it's valid even for this regime, then we can have elements that we can retain if we want to generalize our theory. While if it is violated, then this will point to elements of the theory that we have to modify when we want to put together quantum effects and gravitational effects. So I'm sure you all know what the Einstein equivalence principle is, but just to set the stage for what will come next, let me introduce it a bit more precisely. So it corresponds to the idea that we can transform away gravity locally at a point in spacetime. So in particular, this means that for every point P that we have in a manifold, then we can find a transformation or a coordinate transformation that makes the metric to be locally Minkowski at the point P in the new coordinate system. And just for reference, historically, it has often been confused with the principle of general covariance, which is instead a different thing. And in 1918, Einstein laid down three fundamental principles of GR, where he distinguished the principle of relativity at that point, which instead is about the fact that the laws of physics are formulated in terms of spatiotemporal coincidences of physical systems, which is another thing that we are going to use in the following. And this statement implied the principle of general covariance, which is then something distinct to the Einstein equivalence principle. And so in the way I formulated it, the Einstein equivalence principle relies on the notion of locally inertial frames, which are it's a new coordinate system that I mentioned, where the metric is locally Minkowski at a point. And again, for what will come next, I will review how to build a local inertial frame here. So imagine that we have here a space-time, and we have a coordinate system that we label X, and then we take this point P, XP, which is a specific point in this manifold. And now we want to build a transformation from X to a new coordinate system, Xi, such that the metric is locally Minkowski at this point. So in order to do that, we can tailor expand the coordinate transformation. And it is important for what will follow that we only need the linear term of this transformation. And now if we take these coefficients here, we can give them a name, and we notice that there are 16 free parameters in this transformation. And general relativity tells us how to change, how to transform the metric when we change the coordinate system. And in particular, if we are only care about the value of the metric at point zero, which corresponds to this point here, then we can just evaluate this quantity in zero, and we see that this is fully determined by these coefficients. So once we know the old value of the metric and the coefficients that are the first order expansion of the Taylor series, then the new tensor is determined at zero. So this means that we have 10 quantities to fix here because the metric tensor is symmetric, but we had 16 free parameters. So we can use 10 of these 16 free parameters to choose the new value of the metric field. So this is to say that we can always make it to look like Minkowski. And then I won't go into the proof of this, but then the first corrections that we have are the second order corrections. So to summarize, we can divide this procedure in two steps. The first one is that we recenter the origin of our coordinate system in point XP. And the second step is that we straighten the metric in the neighborhood of point XP. But so what I've just said so far all relies on an abstract notion of reference frames. But even Einstein believed that reference frames are rods and clocks. If we want to think about reference frame in a more operational way, then they are physical systems. And physical systems are ultimately quantum systems, which can show the phenomena of superposition and entanglement. So instead of having the situation that is depicted here, where we have a classical system moving in along a word line in classical space-time, then what we want to do is here is to replace this with something that looks a bit more like that, like the second picture, where instead of having a word line, we have a quantum state. So something that can be in a superposition of positions in space-time. And also want to allow the situation that I was describing at the beginning, where we have masses in a superposition that are the source of a gravitational field. So this means that we want to allow for a superposition of space-times. And to describe this situation, we use the framework of quantum reference frames. Quantum reference frames have been discussed in quantum gravity, quantum information, and quantum foundations since the 60s. But here we use this particular formulation, and which originally had nothing to do with gravity. So it was just phrased in the framework of Galilean quantum mechanics. But let me just use the main idea of this because this will simplify what will come later. So here in this picture, I've represented the situation that in an initial quantum reference frame C, we have two quantum systems A and B, where A is in a superposition of being in X1 and in X2, and B instead is in a sharply localized state in position basis. And now what quantum reference frames allow us to do is to take the perspective of the quantum system A. So basically we want to center the origin of our quantum reference frame in the state that A describes in position basis. And the key in order to do that is to generalize the reference frame transformation to include the Hilbert space of the quantum reference frame explicitly. So we basically apply a superposition of a coherent superposition of classical translations to system B, where the superposition is controlled by the position of system A. And what we get if we do this is a situation from the point of view of A where systems B and C are entangled and the relative distances are preserved. So when A was in X1, then B is in L minus X1 and C is in minus X1. And the same goes when A was in X2. So B will be in L minus X2 and C in minus X2. And this is an entangled state. So now we want to use this to generalize the notion of a local inertial frame and define a quantum local inertial frame where anywhere and anytime in the universe, all the non-gravitational laws of physics must take on their familiar non-relativistic form. So here I've just adapted the formulation of the Einstein equivalence principle from the book Gravitation. And in order to do that, we need three elements. The first one is a gravitational field G, which we want to consider in a superposition of classical states. The second one is a test particle M that surveys the gravitational field. And the third is a particle P that we will always use as our quantum reference frame. So let's make these ideas a bit more precise. So the first thing that we need is to describe a quantum state in space-time. So there is previous literature on what it means to have quantum states in space-time. Carlo, for instance, has written some papers on that. And so this is already a non-trivial step, but I don't have time here to go through all the details. But basically what we do is that we consider time as an operator and we introduce some canonical commutation relations between this x0 and p0. And here the formalism is frozen, so we're not enforcing any dynamics, but if we wanted to enforce these dynamics, this would look like a constraint. The important thing is that this allows us to describe a quantum system not just on a time slice, but in space-time. So it's a covariant way of formulating a quantum state. And the other thing is we introduce a superposition of classical manifolds, and on each manifold, there is a classical gravitational field I label like G1, G2, G3. And so this is the idea that formally corresponds to what I defined previously as superposition of classical spacetimes. And in order to write that, we associate a ket to each classical solution of the gravitational field. And so there is no full framework to do that, but what we assume is that all the classical states are macroscopically distinguishable, which means that they are orthogonal, and that we can apply the principle of linear superposition of quantum theory to the superposition of these states. So once we have this, we basically have a quantum system defined on space-time and a superposition of classical spacetimes. And for each classical spacetime, we will have a different state living on each classical spacetime. So at this point, it looks like we have some disconnected manifolds with a quantum state living on each of them, but we have no way of identifying the points in different manifolds. And so we resort to operational considerations here. And let's define now, I will explain this notation in the next slide, but for now, just take it as we have a quantum state phi and a metric G. And we write this using the principle of linear superposition as the sum of the states living in each classical manifold. And now we want to find a way of identifying a point x0 in the first manifold with a point y1 in the second manifold and the point Z1 in the third manifold. And we do this via a projection operation. So this projector, when applied to this state living in the superposition of different spacetimes, basically identifies operationally these three points that in principle were disconnected before. But now this is not the only choice that we have. We could also identify the points in the three manifolds by a different projector. For instance, we could identify this point x0 with a point y2 and with a point z2. So why do we have these different possibilities of having different projectors? What we interpreted, the way we interpret this is that each projector corresponds to a different measurement choice. So basically, we regard this projector as the abstraction of a measurement apparatus. So it simply means that I once have a measurement apparatus that measures in by identifying this the first three points according to pi 1, 2 pi 1, or another one that identifies them according to pi 2. And now, after we introduce this, we also want to understand what how to associate the value of the metric field when we have a quantum system. Let's think about just classical GR, and let's consider a particle m that has its own word line in spacetime. Now, what we usually do is that we pick a point along the word line of this system that will have some labels in our choice of coordinate system. And we say that at that point, the metric field has some value. And so there is a correlation between the value of some system M and the value of the metric field for some point in the trajectory of the word line of this system. So here, what I'm saying is simply that if we want to have some information about the metric, then we need a physical system. I am not proposing a way of measuring the metric. I know that this is a far more difficult thing to do, and we didn't want to do it here. The only thing that I'm saying is that we get information about the metric via a physical system, whatever this is. And now we want to replace this system with a quantum system in spacetime. And in the same way in which there is this correlation, this classical correlation between the position of the system, of the classical system M and the value of the metric field, we introduce similarly this state of the quantum system M acting on the, this is some action on this triangle on the metric field, such that there is some correlation between the position that the system M has and the metric field. So this is just a system that is whose position is correlated with the position of the metric field, and that we need as an ancillary system to get information on the metric. Finally, we don't want to just stick to this system, but we want to ask what the how can we probe the metric field at some location in spacetime. And in particular, if we have this other system that will be our quantum reference frame in spacetime, then, and this, well, system M that is our test particle, then we want to ask what is the metric field at P? And the first question that comes to our mind if we ask this type of question is, what is how do we know where P is? P is a quantum system that has some quantum state in space-time. There's no, we cannot really associate in a standard way, at least, a position to this quantum system. So the second question can be addressed with quantum reference frames, because what quantum reference frames can do is to, as in the example in the Galilean case that I showed to you before, is to go to the reference frame that is centered in the position of a quantum system by generalizing the reference frame transformation. So in a quantum reference frame sense, it makes sense to ask what is the position of P. And then we can address the second question, what is the metric field at P? And in order to understand this, we can consider the full state of P, M, and the gravitational field. That, again, using the principle of linear superposition, we can write as the linear combination of the states in every classical manifold. And in order to know what the metric field is at P, we introduce a von Neumann-like measurement. So for those of you who are not familiar with the von Neumann measurement, it basically consists in adding an ancilla to the quantum system that we would like to measure, and to have a coupling between the ancilla and this quantum system, and then measuring the ancilla. This is in quantum information. In this case, M plays the role of the ancilla, and P is our quantum system. So here, what this operator does, we can write it in a basis. So if P has position x prime and M has position coordinate x, then this x operator xp picks the position of P and applies a translation by this position of P to system M. So here we will get x minus x prime. And then we project this state after this transformation on the state x equal to zero for M. And if you set this to zero, here you see that you're basically identifying the position of P with the initial position of M. So basically we are forcing M to look at where P is. And that's actually what we get, because the state that we obtain is, M disappeared because we projected on it, and then we get the metric field that is correlated with the position of system P. So let's just summarize what I've said so far before I get to the generalization of the Einstein equivalence principle. So we introduce this particle P that serves as a quantum reference frame. Then we introduced a test particle M that is correlated with the value of the metric field G. Then we asked, what is a quantum state in space-time? And we have seen that we have a covariant representation of this state. The second question we have asked is, how can we write the state of a non-classical gravitational field? And the situation that we consider here is we have a superposition of classical spacetimes. Then we asked, how can we identify points across different spacetimes? And we have introduced this projection operation, which identifies points physically, and we define this identification. So we call this identification a physical point. And finally, we have asked, how can we know what the metric at P is? And we have answered to this question, say, by introducing a von Neumann measurement scheme. So now let's get to the big, so I will just tell you the big picture now, and then we will go through everything in a more detailed way. So the situation, the general situation that we consider here is we have a set of classical manifolds. Here I just have three written down. And then on each one of these, we have a different metric field that is a classic one. And then also on each of them, there is a system P that will be our quantum reference frame, which can have a different state in every classical manifold. And then a system M that is our test particle. And now we want to generalize the transformation to a local inertial frame to a system to transform to the quantum local inertial frame of this quantum system P, which has a quantum state in the superposition of spacetimes. And this consists in applying the principle of linear superposition twice. Once it's within the same spacetime, because system P, if you just consider one single manifold here, one system P, so system P is in a quantum state, so it is in a superposition of positions. And so we will apply a different transformation for every possible position of P in one single manifold. And the second time, it's across different spacetimes, because we want to apply this transformation for each possible value of the metric field. And if you remember, when I introduced the local inertial frames, then we had seen that in order to fix a local inertial frame transformation, we had 16 free parameters that we were free to choose. Now we still have these 16 free parameters, but we can choose a different one at each point xp and in each spacetime gi. But once we do that, everything goes in the same way. So we know how the metric field transforms, and we know that when we evaluate this in xi equal to zero for each manifold, then we have we can still choose these coefficients. So these are the same coefficients, just defined at each different point xp and for each manifold I. So let's restrict now to the case when we have a single classical incurred spacetime. Here, we take a position a system P living in the spacetime, where we have this covariant representation of the state, which is the one that I've introduced before. And then we have a quantum system M, which is our test particle, which is correlated with the value of the gravitational field. And now we have the same strategy that we have for the usual local inertial frame transformation, where we, if you remember, the strategy was that we center the origin at a point xp, and then we straighten the coordinates in the neighborhood of this point. So here we do the same, but we do it for every possible xp. So now imagine, like, forget this integral now, just fix your attention on a single xp. So if we fix xp, then the transformation to the new coordinate system xi is linear in xm. So this is a linear transformation can be represented as a unitary transformation on system m. And then we can control this on every possible value of xp. So whatever the form of this transformation is, then we control it on xp. So we basically promote xp to an operator. And in quantum information language, this is called a quantum control transformation, where the control system is the particle p, and what we would call the target system, which is the one to which the control transformation is applied, is M. And now let's take this and let's generalize it to when we have a superposition of different manifolds. So here we have the same state as before. So this is just the state of P and the state of M correlated with G, but I have just inserted an I everywhere, an I coefficient, to indicate that this can be different for every possible manifold, M1, M2, M3, and so on, up to Mn. And the state in each one of these is linearly superposed to give the full state that we consider. And now, again, we have the same strategy, but this time we do not only have to superpose at each point xp, but also for each different value of the metric. So again, we center the origin and we stretch the coordinates, but this time for each xp and for each value of the metric field, it will be different. So if we take the transformation we had before, what we do is we still have the same transformation for each xp and for each gi, but this will also explicitly depend on the gravitational field. So, but again, this is a unitary transformation, and this is thanks to the fact that the gi's are all orthogonal one with the other. And again, this is a quantum control transformation, but this time the control systems are both P and G. So the last thing that we have to check is that this actually gives us a local inertial frame transformation, so the generalization of a local inertial frame transformation. So how do we check that? We take the state we transform it to the quantum local inertial frame with this unitary operation that we have built. And then we apply the von Neumann measurement scheme that I defined before to probe the value of the metric field at the origin of the quantum local inertial frame, which is what I introduced before as what is the metric at P. And if we do this, then we find that the metric in the quantum local inertial frame is locally Minkowski at the origin of the quantum local inertial frame. And then it has corrections as we go further away from the origin. And these corrections are not only the ones that are due to the Riemann tensor as it would be for like standard local inertial frames, but they will be different because we started with the superposition of classical solutions. So that's everything that I wanted to tell you. And to conclude, what I've presented here is a generalization of quantum reference frames to curl spacetimes and to superpositions of spacetimes. And we have introduced a notion of a quantum local inertial frame. And the statement that can summarize the result that I've presented today is that for every quantum state of a system P living in a superposition of classical spacetimes, one can find a quantum local inertial frame transformation to the quantum reference frame of P, such that the metric is locally Minkowski at the origin of the quantum reference frame. And one last thing that I would like to stress is that everything that I've talked about here is valid when P has no dynamics. So it's a frozen state of P. But actually it is possible, and we do it in the paper, to also basically enforce dynamics. So in particular, we consider freely falling quantum systems. And we also find that in that case as well, we have as an analogous generalization of the Einstein equivalence principle for quantum system freely falling in superposition of spacetimes. And this is all. And with this, I would like to thank you for your attention. And yeah, if you have questions, I'm happy to answer.
Well, thank you, Flaminia, for the very interesting and clear talk.
Thank you.
Okay, so now let's start with the discussion session. And first, I would like to ask if there are questions from students.
Question. Can I ask a question?
First, I'm waiting for the question for students. 1 second.
Okay.
Okay, seems like there are, oh, there is a question by Shawin.
Yes, experimental
Shawin.
Question. So the equivalence principle is usually separated into two parts, the weak equivalence principle and the strong equivalence principle. And the weak equivalence principle says that bodies fall freely fall at the same rate, independent of their composition. The second is the one that you described. In all inertial frames locally, physics takes the same form. So the question is, regarding that there have been experiments performed to find out whether two particles, P1 and P2 with masses, M1 and M2, can show entanglement just through gravity. And so far, experiments have not found any such result, that they are superimposed through just gravity. So what is your opinion about this? You need this superposition experiment to really give your presentation an experimental basis.
Yeah, yeah, thanks for this question. So, experiments. So there are actually experiments. So experiments are, I'm referring in particular to atomic fountains experiments at the moment, in particular to the setup that Mark Hazewich has at Stanford, where they can superpose, so they can build an interferometer where the two branches of the interferometer are subject to different gravitational fields, and they can measure the difference in small g's, and they can put that in a superposition. Now, this would provide, so I haven't developed these ideas, but I would say that this is a promising setup to think about an analogous generalization of the weak equivalence principle to this type of scenarios when the particles are in different gravitational fields. By gravitational field, I mean the one with small g, the linear one, the linear gravitational potential. And then, okay, to go to the Einstein equivalence principle, there are additional steps. And one could think, for instance, of the Schiff conjecture that tells us that if we should also test the universality of the gravitational redshift, and this plus the weak equivalence principle, this should be, in principle, it should give us the Einstein equivalence principle. So along these lines, I think that this type of effect could be tested in an experiment. And we should find results that are in agreement with the existence of, with the generalization of the Einstein equivalence principle, if this is correct. But
I just one comment that from what I understand from reading the papers on these experiments, they seem to be about three or four orders of magnitude away at present from getting an experimental result. Of course, in the future, we don't. It's possible that we can reach to the three or four orders of that are required. I mean, quite possible. Yeah. I mean, hopefully.
So there are two things. One is the fact that the quantum system is in a superposition and it defines a quantum reference frame. And another story is to actually put a mass in a quantum superposition such that it can generate a superposition of gravitational fields. So there are two different effects here. And the first one, the quantum superposition of the quantum system itself could in principle be tested. The second one, which is the superposition of gravitational fields, is much harder at the moment. But there could be experiments in like 20, 30 years doing that.
Thank you.
Next, there is a question by Shoin. I'm asking you to unmute yourself.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
So thank you. So you mentioned that you can have the superposition of different manifold, and you can do different projection, meaning the different measurements. So I'm not sure if I understand, how do you decide how many manifolds you have? Are you assuming that the time is discrete so that you can have a discrete manifold to do the superposition? And should we have an infinite number of the manifolds to do the superposition?
Okay,
and
so
one more question. So can you explain, I'm not sure if I understand, what do you mean by this, a different measurement or different projections physically?
Okay, yeah, so first maybe the question on the number of manifolds. So I imagine this superposition of manifolds as I put a mass in a superposition, and if it's in a superposition such that for each position you have a classical gravitational field, so imagine like a small ball like that I put here, this is the source of a classical gravitational field, and then I put it in a superposition of being here and there, where for each one of these positions I have a classical gravitational field, and here I have two manifolds, so two superpositions. So a superposition of n equal to 2. And then I put it in a superposition of 3, and I have n equal to 3, and then I can increase this. So it's really a choice of the physical situation. It's the number n is really depends on the physical situation that you're considering. And then you had another question. Could you please repeat it?
What do you mean by this measurement here?
Okay, yeah, sorry, yeah, the projector. So the projection is just a way to operationally identify points in different manifolds. So you can imagine that as like every other physical system, a measurement apparatus is a physical system, but this is a very good measurement apparatus. So in each manifold, it has a very sharp position. And then you decide, you experimenter, decide how to put your measurement apparatus, and as every other physical system, this will live in the superposition. And then the coincidence of your measurement apparatus with whatever lives on each manifold then gives you the operational identification of these points across these manifolds. I don't know if this answers your question.
I think it does, thank you.
Okay, next there is a question by Martin
Green. Hi, I'm interested in, you know, first of all, this notion of an inertial frame. You have constructed a coordinate system, so you can find that the metric is locally Minkowski. But normally, an inertial frame, one needs to consider not only the frame at a given point of time, but you need to look at the evolution of that frame. And a frame is inertial if the motion of particles within this extended frame along the timeline is Newtonian. So for example, if you used a regular lattice drawn on a turntable and you have the turntable rotating, then the surface of the turntable together with the vertical direction, which is invariant, would not constitute an inertial frame. That would be a rotating frame. And so that's distinguishing between a frame at an instant of time as opposed to an inertial frame, which has to persist over time. And then if you're looking at inertial motion, you want the motion over that extended time to be Newtonian, or in the case of quantum theory, to satisfy, say, the Schrodinger equation written in what one presumes are inertial coordinates as opposed to written in rotating coordinates. So that's, I guess, the first challenge. But the second issue is that one normally in general relativity doesn't consider the metric to be the gravitational field. The gravitational field is actually the curvature, and the metric is merely a potential. So it's only the second derivatives of the metric that give you the curvature, and the curvature is then the physically significant field. And as Einstein said, you can do an experiment in a freely falling elevator, and you only detect the gravitational field through its tidal effects. And in an inertial frame, the tidal effects don't produce any rotation. So they will squash or stretch and squash a set of test particles relative to each other, but they won't induce any rotation of the set of test particles. So I think that's going quite a bit beyond what you've demonstrated. Have you addressed this in your paper, or is that still work to be done?
Okay, so let me clarify. So here we are only talking about this local inertial frame, which is something that is, we just really took the textbook definition of local inertial frame and we just generalized it. We didn't do something like...
Even a local inertial frame in the textbook is defined to such that it's not rotating over time. So it's a difficult concept, but you can imagine a frame, as I said, a turntable, which can be rotating, and that's no longer an inertial frame. Well, at any instant of time, it's a perfectly good orthonormal frame.
I don't really know what to answer here. I mean, I think we just really took the textbook definition of a local inertial frame and we just moved on from that. And this is usually defined at a single point. So really like not really considering an extended region in space-time. What one can do that is a little bit beyond that is, and we did it in the paper, but I didn't present it here, is to consider Fermi normal coordinates. And that's like the next step where you can set the metric to be Minkowski along a geodesic, and also the first derivative of the metric to vanish along the geodesic. But
an inertial frame, because you're now looking at the motion along a geodesic. And if you're working in Fermi normal coordinates, then the standard frame in which the metric maintains that Minkowski form along the metric is a local inertial frame. But if you're doing it just at a point, you can't define an inertial frame at a point. You can define an orthonormal frame, but it's not an inertial frame. The inertial frame only gains definition by looking at its evolution along a geodesic trajectory.
Well, I'm pretty sure that a local inertial frame is defined at a single point.
Okay. And this question of using the metric as your notional gravitational field, as opposed to using the curvature as the gravitational field. So that, again, in general relativity, you have to go not just to a local neighborhood, but you have to go to second order to get the curvature. And so at first order, there is no gravitational field. All you have is a locally Minkowski geometry.
Well, but for instance, you can still have effects due to the gravitation, like the gravitational redshift is a G00 effect, and it's a,
but that's not
a gravitational effect that depends on the metric.
It's not local. All right. So the redshift is something that's measured over a long distance. You can't measure, I mean, if you have a local redshift, then this is a Doppler shift. You can have a particle that's moving rapidly within the local environment. But if you're looking at redshift of a different distant star, that exists because it's a long distance effect and curvature enters in. All right. So anything local.
Aren't you mistaking the question of the equivalence principle with the question of testing for a gravitational, to measure a gravitational field? The equivalence principle, I think, correctly says at a point an observer can go into a local inertial frame by free falling. And it says all measurements to zeroth order in any scale of curvature will be as in special relativity. And I think that's what they've generalized. And that's, as far as I can see, correct. You can certainly measure an acceleration to zeroth order in a radius of curvature.
That's right, but you're not measuring any gravitational effect, and that's really what I'm.
I think that's you're making a verbal argument. Yeah. Well, that is measuring a gravitational effect, if the equivalence principle is true. Mainly, the gravitational effect is the absence of being able to measure a deviation from special relativity to zeroth order in any radius of curvature.
Yeah, I mean, you agree. Flamini is asking if this is the same as doing quantum gravity. So it's, where is the point?
The point is that this is not extending to the level that that curvature becomes of consequence.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's the point of an equivalence principle test.
Can the same be doing quantum gravity? That's the question Flamini is addressing.
Okay.
Okay, so now I see that there is a question from a student, so I would give priority to this question. Hank, can you unmute yourself and ask your question?
Hello. So if you can hear me, my question is like, how you're constructing these states, they're sort of like, you're taking linear combinations of a physical state and then with states that are labeled by these metrics. So you have a whole bunch of, I guess, layers or copies of the Riemannian surface and then with different metrics, and then you're taking linear combinations of the states. Then if that's true, then can I interpret that as some sort of, some form of like a tensor product state?
Tensor product between like the gravitational field M and P.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But because I'm mainly just, you know, more used to working with sort of finite gauges. I'm a kinetic matter. I'm coming from a kinetic matter background. So I'm just wondering, like, because, you know, you have like a whole space, a moduli space of metrics to choose from, right? And then you have infinite many, I guess in general, infinitely many metrics, like the basis is infinite for the moduli space. So I'm just wondering how you would control that when you're defining that state.
Sorry, I don't think I get your question.
So the basis and the, if you're taking linear combination of metrics in the moduli space of metrics, right? That moduli space is infinite dimensional, typically. I'm just wondering how you will control that linear combination.
So controlling which sense, sorry?
Like convergence.
Conversions?
Yeah.
Okay, so we don't have an arbitrary linear combination of these states. We have this assumption that the states are all orthogonal. So this is not a full basis of states. And of course, it would be very interesting to go beyond this assumption, but at the moment, this is what we are working with.
Okay, I see.
Okay, next is Carlo.
Thank you, Alessia. Thank you, Flaminia. I'm unmuted. Yes, I am. I have zillions of questions, but there's no time for that. Yeah, really. No, I mean, I wish we could find some time to discuss this in detail because I mean,
whenever you want.
Yeah, as usual. I mean, the thing you do, there's something very great in this thing you're doing, and something that I get confused and disturbs me. I don't want to go to the full thing. Let me just ask two questions. One very general, one specific. The very general is this, just about what you're doing. there are many approaches to quantum gravity. There are many theories of quantum gravity out there. You may say, well, they have some problems or whatever, but they're there. I mean, there's the effective perturbative quantum field theory, which, you know, you can compute gravitational effects all the way almost to Planck scale, and is a perfectly predictive theory, very consistent, and can be used in the there's, I don't know, causal dynamical triangulation, asymptotic freedom, strings, loops, spin forms, whatever. I mean, there's a, so is the this quantum equivalence principle true or false within these theories?
That's a very good question. I would like to know.
Somehow, I mean, just so why invent the you know, thing from scratch? I mean, there's been, take one of these theories, the one you like. It's then you can do, I mean, perhaps not technically in the details, but these are questions that can be addressed within any theory. Mm-hmm. Why not doing it?
Well, I don't have anything against doing that. It's just that this is the language that I'm mostly familiar with. So that's basically the why I do it in this way, because here I have a better intuition of what is going on. But in, of course, I would be very interested in knowing whether there's any quantum gravity approach that is consistent with this thing that we've developed here, or if it's in contradiction, and to find out, well, if it agrees, why it agrees, and if it doesn't agree, why it doesn't agree, and to compare the predictions that one would have in these two different cases. It's something that would be really interesting
to find out. Okay, I understand. The technical question is this. Something I got confused technically. P, how many degrees of freedom it has? Roughly, I mean, it's a three or four or 10 or many.
It's a 10. Continuous variable system.
It's a continuous variable system. So it's infinite.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's like a true reference system. I mean,
yeah.
Okay. And M.
Same.
Or the same.
Yeah.
Okay, and so maybe my question is, do you really need both to articulate this argument?
Yeah, I've tried to get rid of one of them.
it seems to me, I mean, I'd be totally wrong. That's why I would like to sit in front of Blackwell with you. It seems to me you're making a long turn, but the sharp point is, we already had this argument about your quantum mechanics references. In a sense, I mean, if you think in terms of relative variables, you can say the same thing with the same result at the same point without overcharging the story. I mean, the metric is observable. It's not true that only the curvature is observable with respect to a set of objects. I mean, if it's a set of objects, put numbers here: 1, 2, 3, 4. And the physical distance between this and that, which I can measure with whatever, I mean, light going back and forth or ruler.
Yes.
Is GXX component in these coordinate systems.
Yes.
So if you just use this logic, and then you say, well, G mu nu is a superposition and this object is a superposition. That's it. You already have all the ingredients, seem to me. Or maybe I'm missing a part of the story.
No, okay. So I understand why you're confused, because I was also very confused when I was doing the calculations, and I've tried for quite long to get rid of system M and just use the quantum reference frame and apply just on the metric field. So now I do not know whether there is a different representation of the state of G which would allow you to get rid of system M. But the way I understand this now, and this might change in a few months, I'm not saying that this won't happen, is that the system P and system M basically are your this and that. So it provides check the distance from this to that, and check the distance from P to M. And having both of them allow us to implement this unitary transformation on the quantum system. Otherwise, I wouldn't have an X degree of freedom on which to apply the superposition of translations. So this is the intuition that I have. But
okay,
yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that this is the definite word on this.
To explain me in detail and convince me, but I think we're communicating on what is the, what is the. I mean, the way you introduced N here is because I mean, you refer to all the Kretschmer story. I mean, the Einstein idea that you need points to be defined by things, and so it's a particle that defines where you are in a sense. But if you have a reference frame, you already have it. But you say this is not the reason for introducing N. It's because of having, well, whatever. I'll try to digest it and read your paper better and hope to discuss it better. And also I hope to address the other questions, because I think this is, I think if this is useful, it's going to be useful in a concrete context. I mean, is this still implementing this or not? So is a quantum superposition principle true in just, you know, standard perturbative?
Yeah.
Effective quantum gravity, which in principle allows us to discuss. I mean, in standard perturbative effective quantum gravity, which is the stupidest thing of all, it just fails at the Planck scale, but who calls it the Planck scale, or Planck energy? Who cares in this experiment, right? You can put a metric in a superposition of two things, and then you can ask how to bring the two words together. And basic quantum field theory answers that. If you fold the gauge in and everything. So it should be either true or not true. And I suspect it's just true. At
the
least
principle of superposition.
Gravity, for the way loop quantum gravity is constructed, for instance, and similar theories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this would be very interesting to understand. And yeah, I don't know. I have this intuition that at some point it should break down, but I don't know like at which point it would break down. Maybe for everything that we care about so far, it doesn't break down, and then we need something really wild for it to break down, or maybe it never breaks down, I don't know. But yeah, that's another very interesting point.
In the days of Luke, we were long confused about that. If you have superposition geometry, what it means to, how do you put them together, how do you identify points? And somehow the way out was along your lines. I mean, you don't identify points, you ask physical questions. A physical question is, what is the metric where this particle is? So it's a particle which is in both states that tell you how to connect. So the right question is, with respect to this particle, I know you're asking the particle itself is spread. So great, so how does this, my intuition is that if you go to fully gauge invariant relative variables, it's just one variable, which is the metric with respect to the particle. And with respect to that, I think, I don't know, but I think the question you're asking is great. It's a local gravitational field, just Minkowski, always, in spite of everything else. Okay, we just comment.
Yeah, sure, but thanks.
I just wanted to get back to my original question experiment. If you can't in the future, being devil's advocate, if you can't in the future have an experiment that demonstrates the two particles of mass M1 and M2 can entangle quantum mechanically through just gravity, then you have to start worrying about this, the whole central issue of quantum gravity as an experimental phenomenon beyond just mathematical abstractions. And we need these experiments. I know it's fatuous of me to say this, but we do have, physics ultimately is an experimental subject.
Yeah, I agree. We need the experiments, and we are waiting for the experimentalists.
Okay, so there is another question related to quantum gravity that is an anonymous question. So now I'm copying it on the chat for reference for everybody. And the question is, which existing theories of quantum gravity obey the generalized equivalence principle and which don't? That is, similar to the question, the first question by Carlo. So maybe the person who asked the question can also follow up in case your previous reply here was not enough. Or Flaminia, you can also comment more on the question.
Yeah, the honest answer is that I do not know which ones would obey, but I agree that it's a very interesting thing to find out. And if mm-hmm. any of you knows more than me, I'll be happy to learn from you.
So if the person asked the question wants to follow up, it is a good point to do that. Okay, so if not, then there is one more question by Benjamin.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, perfect, thank you. So I was wondering about this notion of going into a reference frame of kind of a superposition of particles, and what you mean by the value of the metric in that frame. So obviously you have some extended object, right? So let's say a wave function, which is not at a single point. So what do you mean, first of all, what is the metric field at that point, which is actually many points? And then why do you expect that it works, that you can actually define an inertial reference frame on this collection of points that you have Minkowski space spread out over this wave function, let's say?
Okay, so it's true, we have a quantum system living in, let's take just one single manifold to make it easier. So we have a quantum system on a classical spacetime, on a curved classical spacetime. And then what we do is we define a transformation, so a coordinate transformation so one should not think about it as the usual coordinate transformation, because what we're doing here is we are identifying all points, all possible points that are covered in by the quantum reference frame as the origin. So it is a superposition of usual coordinate transformations. And this allows us to go to the quantum reference frame at this point. So at this point, we do not have a collection of points anymore, but just by taking the relative variables to this quantum system in particular, then we can basically the point where this quantum system is just is a single point in the new coordinate system. And again, at that point, we can ask, so it is meaningful to ask at the origin of this quantum reference frame, which corresponded in the previous coordinate system to this quantum state that was in a superposition, but now it's just the origin of the quantum reference frame, to ask what is the value of the metric field at this point. And if we do this superposition of transformations to the local inertial frame, and this superposition is the quantum local inertial frame transformation, then we can find that we have that the metric reduces to Minkowski at the single point, and then it has corrections in the neighborhood.
So in a sense, you change the topology that you apply to your manifold. Could you say that?
We change the topology.
In the sense that you, let's say in the first frame where your state is extended, it's actually extended another point, and then you do this transformation, and then suddenly in this, let's say, new topology, so to say, this is a single point, your origin of the new frame.
Well, so we, so it's a unitary transformation, so it doesn't really change the topology. I wouldn't know what a good word would be to define this. But yeah, in a sense, so maybe it's easier if you think about it as relational variables. So you just take the relative variables of like a system that is in a superposition of positions and your initial coordinate system. And if you express these in your relative coordinates, then if all the coordinates are defined where the quantum system initially was living, then by definition, more or less, you end up with the fact that the origin of your quantum reference frame is the position of this particle. But I don't know if this was clear.
Maybe let me slightly rephrase the question to just get the idea that you have in mind. So going back to the first frame where the state is extended, you might expect that there is some curvature across the state, right? So that different parts of the state just have different curvatures. So naively, I would expect that no matter what transformation I do, I cannot get rid of this kind of intrinsic curvature spread over my state. So
curvature, now you're talking about the curvature of space-time.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So how can I, I just don't really...
Yeah, so the curvature is not touched by this transformation because it's the second derivative and...
Sorry, you say that in your new frame, in this quantum inertia frame, you do have essentially Riemann coordinates at this point, but... That kind of, I don't know, that doesn't fit together for me because there's some intrinsic non-locality in there, if you want. So yeah, maybe it's just my confusion. But,
Carlo, you're muted.
Thank you. No, just helping in, maybe just to help the discussion because it's the second, third time that comes out. There's this point versus neighborhood versus curvature. Curvature has a scale. Think about classical generativity. In original space-time, curvature has a certain value, so it's a certain scale, the scalar curvature. With respect to that scale, if you go to a region which is finite, but small with respect to that scale, to zero order, you're flat. To zero order, you're on a point. To first order, you're flat. To second order, you see it. So Flamini is not changing the standard way of thinking about that in classical generativity. So in classical generativity, once you have the scale of curvature, you can take a finite region such that it's Minkowski up to corrections, because small in the size of your region divided the radius of curvature. So the point of Flaminia, it's actually a finite region, small with respect to the curvature. And what she's doing is that instead of doing this standard thing in a classical single space-time, she's doing it in a superposition of space-time over a superposition of coordinate, of physical object that define coordinates. So I think it's clean. It's completely clean, this part.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so I see two more questions. Mark, what?
Lee has his hand raised, but you're muted, Lee.
Yes, but first there is Andrea.
Oh, okay.
Mine is a very, I think it's a short question related to this last point. So if you start with one particle in a superposition of locations in a single space-time, and you move to that reference frame, do you then obtain that the gravitational field is in a superposition? That locally it's flat, and then as you look further away, you start seeing the superposition.
Yeah.
You see this is what you see. Because maybe that makes sense. Okay, cool. Anyway, I will look at the paper in detail because it's very, very interesting. I just wanted to ask you this tiny question.
Next, Lee.
Yes, I was wondering if we're putting the cart, so to speak, at the wrong place. So let me try a formulation of the Einstein equivalence principle, and then Flaminia, see if it extends to your case in a way that is the same as you do if it's different. I don't need to talk about frames of reference to talk about the first equivalence principle. And Carlos said this very clearly, so I'll just repeat what Carlos said. You have two experiments. One of them is in the presence of gravitational fields, so Newton's constant is not zero. And the other one is at Newton's constant equals zero. The question is, if you are in a freely falling situation in the first experiment where Newton's constant is not zero, are you able to still to zeroth order in that constant to claim that all of your physics is as if you were in special relativity, that is at Newton's constant equals zero? And whatever you do with superpositions of histories, histories of metrics, et cetera, it's a question of equivalence between those two experimental situations. One of them in a world where Newton's constant is not zero, but you can take limits in which it becomes small, and the other one in Newton's constant is zero. And I'm putting it that way because it may be that in the second world, even if Newton's constant is zero, there's a concept of superpositions of flat spacetimes, which might bring various kinds of effects, which you would then might talk about in terms of quantum reference frame.
And which type of effects do you have in mind for this superposition of classical spacetimes?
I think I have in mind the same effects that Einstein had in mind, going to first order or second order in Newton's constant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is an interesting observation. I haven't thought about it in these terms, but I mean, you're right, one should get something like that.
Well, thank you. Maybe, maybe not, we should look into it, but I'm wondering if the detour through quantum reference frames are very interesting and very useful, but they may be making it, you have to climb over a big hill to get to something that the point is not really quantum reference frames.
Yeah.
They work in both cases.
Yeah, that's a very concrete possibility. Yes, I agree. And yeah.
Could I make a comment? The strong equivalence principle is only valid in a purely metric theory of gravity, which is what Einstein's gravity theory is. As soon as you add an extra degree of freedom, gravitational degree of freedom, you break the strong equivalence principle. For example,
That's very helpful. That's true. And that's the kind of thing I was trying to get to by comparing not two situations in one theory,
yeah,
but situations in one theory with Newton's constant and with another theory, which is not a theory of gravity and has no Newton's constant.
For example, in branch-sticky gravity theory or my modified gravity theory, scalar tensor vector gravity, an extra degree of freedom, gravitational degree of freedom, is added. So if you go to an inertial frame, the extra gravitational degree of freedom is not zero. So Einstein's theory is very special.
But John, I don't understand. If your scalar degree of freedom is there, whether you're in special relativity or general relativity, then the two things are equivalent. And that's an instance of the equivalence principle.
Well,
if you have another field that has other effects,
yeah,
it will be present in both cases. And the only thing that I think we need to distinguish is the case of a theory with gravity with Newton's constant not zero, and a theory with Newton's constant zero.
Yeah, but the point is a zero order in expansion of the metric phi is not zero. Not zero gravitational field. But so I agree, it's the same. It can be the, it's not even necessarily the same in every inertial frame. For example, in the case of Maxwell's theory, you have a Lorentz force.
No, John, that's exactly the point I'm making. I'm trying very explicitly not to compare two different theories, which is a rather abstract thing to do, but to compare two different experiments.
Okay, no, I just wanted to make the comment that it's a pure, Einstein says, a purely metric theory, and that this plays an important role in defining the equivalence principle. Whether you do quantum gravity or not, you see, when you do quantum gravity, you may risk having an alternative theory besides the purely metric classical theory of GR.
Okay, so are there further questions? Yes, so I see one by Carlo.
A completely unrelated thing. Flamini, I want to know what you think about that. You've been thinking about sort of low energy situations in which you can superimpose semi-classical geometries and everything falls naturally. But do you expect, would you think this quantum equivalence principle to hold for real at any scale? I mean, the opposite intuition being, all right, so when I go small, I get the superposition principle, the equivalence principle, I have to go small. But if I go so small that I get a Planck scale, then I get all the crazy fluctuations of quantum gravity, and therefore, in some sense, I'm not in Minkowski space anymore. Would that be against or not, would you say? It's a transversal thing, but...
Yeah, no, I've been trying to think about this, and I really have. So somehow I would tend to think that it will break down at some point, but I do not have any concrete basis on which I could say so. So it just that, I don't know, it seems that it extends naturally as long as the superposition principle holds, but once this is no longer true, then there's no reason for it to be valid anymore. So it could as well be that it will stop working at some point, and there but I don't know how to substitute it with.
Okay.
Well, I think Carlos' point is very relevant. Because as you get down to very small scales with your quantum gravity theory, he's right. You start getting gravitational fluctuations.
Right, so we have two scales in the theory. We have, if you are somewhere...
It's going to break down.
There's a curvature scale there.
Yeah.
Here on Earth is 10 to the minus, I don't remember, 19 or whatever.
Right.
From Schwarzschild. And then there's a Planck scale.
Yes.
So there's a huge space in between in which the principle could be right, and of course it goes wrong when you go to the curvature.
So it's going to have to break down at some point.
In some sense, because we expect Lorentz invariance to be still true in the small, but not in the sense of being like in Minkowski. But I don't know, this doesn't question what you're doing, it's just a side remark.
Well, Lorentz invariance won't be violated. It's a question of whether the equivalence principle is still true at very small scales. I doubt it. I think you're right, actually.
It's going to be very difficult to construct an experimental apparatus at those very small scales.
Can I interrupt? Yeah. Can I interrupt for a minute? I think we're working under a principle in which we give priority to younger people who don't speak yet. after somebody has spoken 5 or 6 times, maybe we should see if somebody else has something to say.
Yeah, we had 2 or 3 questions from students, but of course, if there are other people who want to ask questions, they are welcome to do so now.
Completely unrelated, but like experimental, like, has anyone ever considered putting something like an atomic interferometer in a centrifuge to test this kind of thing, to like have a really strong field just by using a centrifuge? Like, would that predict it? Would this kind of theory predict any difference if I were in a centrifuge or not?
So I know that there is a group in Vienna. So for like unrelated reasons. So this is a Rupert Hurzing group in Vienna. At the Institute for Quantum Optics and Quantum Information. And so they do satellite-based tests, and they needed to have basically an entangled source which could resist very heavy accelerations. So they have put these sorts in a centrifuge. I think they test, I'm not sure of the numbers, but I think they tested 150 Gs. So like, pretty strong accelerations, and they were trying to violate Bell inequalities with that. They even put it in a car to just make it bump, basically. And so there are these type of tests as far as I know, but I do not know whether something has been done with massive particles, and which I guess would change something, because well, photons travel like at the velocity of light. So there are some differences in the way you describe photons and the way you describe massive systems, which could turn into qualitative differences.
I see. All right. Thank you.
So I think I saw also a question by Dean, or at least he was showing up.
Yes. Thanks, Alessia. I just wonder if, I mean, if you have a broader goal you want to achieve, and what are your planned next steps?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things would be to go beyond the superposition of orthogonal states, and to see if it holds when, because one of the reasons why this transformation is unitary is that the gravitational states are orthogonal. And if you go beyond that, then I don't know what happens. And intuitively, this also corresponds to gravitational, so to the state of a gravitational field that is not, so where the two amplitudes are not macroscopically distinguishable. So there are more questions to be asked. And maybe also more directly related to a more complex regime that could be described also by quantum gravity theories. So this is one of the directions.
I guess naively, I would expect you can always expand in an orthogonal basis. So everything you can reduce to the setup.
But here you're relying on the fact that each element is a classical solution of the gravitational field, which in an arbitrary orthogonal basis would not be true. So you could find an orthogonal basis, but I wouldn't know what this would correspond to physically.
I see. Thanks.
Okay. So since we're running out of time, I would suggest this is a good point to stop the discussion. And so I would like to ask everybody to unmute yourself to thank Flaminia for her very interesting talk, and also for the discussion. So thank you, Flaminia.
Thank you.